Visiting the food pantry helps, he said, though if they sometimes lack the selection of foods preferred by his family. He said, there's no other choice. We have to survive. According to a new opinion poll, more than two-thirds of Americans say they disapprove of how President Joe Biden is handling inflation, which is creating hardship for most people in the United States. The ABC News Ipsos opinion poll released recently found that 69% of the American public disapprove of how the Democratic president, Joe Biden, has handled inflation, while only 28% said they approve. Some 94% of Republicans said they disapprove, while 54% of Democrats said the same about the issue. 71% of independent voters said they disapprove of Biden's performance. 57% of voters said they disapprove of Biden's performance on economic recovery. Only 36% and 32% of those surveyed approved of Biden's handling of crime and gun violence. The opinion poll comes as inflation rates continue to soar. Recently, reports said that consumer prices had risen by 6.8% in the past year, leading into November, which is the highest annual inflation rate since 1982. The grim economic situation has posed a political nightmare for the Biden administration and cemented expectations for the Federal Reserve to start raising interest rates next year. President Biden said recently that he believed the U.S. was currently at the peak of the inflation crisis and that inflation would drop after the Senate passed the Build Back Better Act, a key part of his agenda. An expert has warned the high rate of inflation in the United States is devastating to everyday Americans, calling for the rising prices to be curbed. Gilbert Garcia, a managing partner at Garcia Hamilton & Associates in Houston, Texas, said the U.S. Central Bank needs to immediately get the rising inflation rate under control by raising interest rates. Speaking of predictions that the recent increase in prices are temporary, Garcia told CNBC Financial Advisors Summit, "I wished we'd retire the word transitory." He said inflation is running at 6%, probably well over 6%, no matter how you look at it. It's pretty clear that it's longer than transitory and it's much hotter than their inflationary target. He went on to say that the US Federal Reserve should lift interest rates, noting that the government is currently keeping them artificially low. A few days ago, US Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen admitted that high inflation increased higher and lingered much longer than they had expected. Jerome Powell told a hearing before the House Financial Services Committee on 1st of December, he said, "Inflation has been more persistent and higher than we've expected."
Midstream.
Yemenis wrongfully allied with the U.S.-Saudi aggression in the south now fear a repetition of the Afghanistan scenario in their areas. They are closely watching how during the past week Saudi Arabia has evacuated most of the military camps it occupied in the southern governorates. In parallel, it is now rare to find Emirati forces in many southern regions since the Emirati forces had previously begun a massive evacuation of their own forces after enduring a series of military blows by the Yemeni armed forces. The U.S.-Saudi-UAE coalition of aggression's problem now is no longer about what is happening in Ma'rib. Everyone, without exception, is proceeding as if the city has already fallen. Ma'rib is a done deal, liberated and on the road to recovery. What is actually undergoing these days are negotiations between the Sana'a government and a number of tribes from the people of the Valley District adjacent to Ma'rib from the southeastern side, in addition to the city itself, amid a massive exodus of the stranger mercenaries who feel unwelcomed by the city's residents. Discussions focus on a single option: spare the city blood and destruction and repeat the experience of Al-Hazm, the capital of Al-Jawf, in which the tribes agreed to a settlement that ended up handing it over to the leadership of the Yemeni armed resistance without battles. The Saudis have entered a new phase of fatigue and frustration. All the forces and tribes that they have been funding and arming over the past 6 months have not provided any remedy to stop the Ansarullah offensive. Even when the British forces succeeded in modifying the battle plan by instigating clashes on the side of Al-Shabwa and Al-Dalia, the result was that Ansarullah eased its attack on Ma'rib and directed its forces towards the south, achieving progress beyond what was intended. This allowed Ansarullah for the first time in years to return to southern regions, albeit through a settlement with the local tribes there. The additional support the Saudis got from the Americans did not work. Neither the hastily brought in F-16 squadron succeeded in repelling the ground attacks, nor the network of drones deployed around the clock succeeded in stopping the Yemeni military strikes, nor did all the indiscriminate bombing raids prevent the forces from advancing. What comes next, you may ask? All military and security eavesdropping stations operating in the Red Sea and around Yemen learned that the Ansarullah command directed the operations room to prepare a quick plan aimed at regaining the Strait of Bab al-Mandab immediately after the completion of the Ma'rib battle. Special forces have already begun taking over the mountains surrounding Hudaydah, aiming all the way to Mukha and Bab al-Mandab. Phones are ringing off the hook across the Arab world and beyond in paranoia of the situation. It seems that next month will be a vital one in completing the full liberation of Yemen. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. While the eyes in Yemen are on the Ma'rib battle in recent days, new developments have been taking place in the port city of Hudaydah, increasingly changing the battleground circumstances in favor of the Yemeni armed forces. After a sudden retreat of the UAE-backed forces from Hudaydah in western Yemen, Ansarullah movement took control of major parts of the strategic province. The withdrawal process carried out by militias loyal to Saudi-Emirati alliance from large areas of the western coast opens the door to dramatic developments in other areas, especially in Shabwa Governorate, which appears to be the next destination for the power struggle, with Saudi Arabia racing to consolidate its cards there, hoping maybe to reap future gains that might compensate its expected loss in Ma'rib. To discuss this issue with us from Brussels is Brecht Jonkers, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Brecht. Now, hundreds of Yemenis in this city of Hudaydah expressed their happiness over the withdrawal of the UAE occupation forces and the reopening of the Kilo 16 road, as the city has been under siege for almost 3 years now. How do you assess the importance of this development in Hudaydah in parallel to what was going on in Ma'rib?
Well, I think there is absolutely no way to overstate just how important this really is. The Kilo 16 road, as you mentioned, is indeed a very important connection route between Hudaydah and the Yemeni hinterland. In fact, it is probably the most important highway, the most important route between the port city of Hudaydah, which is the most important, you know, port city in the free parts of Yemen, and the capital of Sana'a. So there are millions and millions of people who live in the liberated and the free parts of Yemen, in the north and in the west of Yemen, who are, for a major part, unfortunately at this point, dependent on aid and on transportation that comes in from the coastline that they're holding near the port city of Hudaydah. And especially when you realize that now, finally, under international pressure, there have been slowly some developments in the fact that fuel shipments and also food shipments and international humanitarian aid has finally been seeping through the Saudi blockade into the city of Hudaydah. So when you take those things into account, when you have the city of Hudaydah slowly but surely starting to receive finally these life-saving necessary shipments that are necessary for the survival of millions of people who have been living under blockade and under war for nearly 7 years now. When you take that into account and combine it with the final reopening of this route that has been blocked for the past 3 years, that will allow, hopefully, unhindered and unlimited transportation of the goods that come in from Hodeidah to the very densely populated areas of Sana'a and its surroundings. This is a matter of life and death for countless of millions of Yemenis that are relying on this. We're talking fuel, we're talking food, we're talking medicines. And we're also talking in a more strategic military aspect, the liberation and the security of the city of Hodeidah and of several areas in the western coast. For example, the city of Al Duraimi, which has been under constant threat of war and conflict for years now. So when you see that...
That's really important, but there's something that most observers are claiming, which I don't really agree with, but here's what they're saying. They're saying that this retreat from Hodeidah is related to an agreement with Sana'a to make concessions to Ansarullah in exchange for retreating from the siege of Ma'rib or Taaz. However, if this was a concession, why did Saudi Arabia bomb Yemen 65 airstrikes, Mr. Brecht, in less than 24 hours last week, just after the liberation of Hodeidah?
Yes, exactly. Like, I think you already basically mentioned what the problem is with this line of reasoning that they're using. Basically, what the Saudis are doing is they're trying to cover up in the media, trying to cover up their failures. This is one line that they're using. I've also read other lines in which they say, oh, we're just retreating from Hodeidah because that is what the Stockholm Agreement said, that we should redeploy and we should desist from conflict because Hodeidah is a ceasefire zone, which of course is also ludicrous because the ceasefire was signed years ago, and so far, for all those years, the Saudis have never bothered to adhere to the principles of the ceasefire. So why do they suddenly do so now? I think the real reason is twofold, and has nothing to do with a secret agreement with Ansarullah for the National Salvation Government, and has nothing to do with the fact that they finally woke up and realized that they should probably keep to a ceasefire agreement that they literally signed. But in reality, what it has to do with is two things. That is, one, they know that their position is militarily untenable on the West Coast, and two, that they need every single man they can get in order to try to defend key cities in the center of the country, like Ma'rib and Taiz. And that is exactly what they're trying to do now. They are withdrawing from the West Coast, from areas that they consider maybe not strategically too important and untenable militarily, and trying to redeploy the Saudi, Emirati, and mercenary forces in Ma'rib, in Taiz, in order to...
I doubt that would actually play off to their benefit, but in retaliation to those Saudi airstrikes, we did see Ansarullah target the King Abdullah Airport and four Aramco refineries in the city of Jeddah, in addition to the King Khalid base in the capital Riyadh and Abha International Airport as well. That took place as Ansarullah were also advancing in Shabwa, which, by the way, was made way by the UAE by turning fire to Shabwa, and Hodeidah aiming also now to retain the Strait of Bab al-Mandeb. Now, obviously, Mohammed bin Salman can do nothing about it anymore, but will this push maybe the U.S. or maybe the British forces to take matters into their own hands, and maybe rather than risk lose such a vital waterway like Bab al-Mandeb?
I think that is definitely something that is being negotiated and discussed about. And this is also why there has been this recent mass sale of military equipment again to Saudi Arabia by this time the Joe Biden administration. And that is why there is still a push by war hawks and by the neoconservatives and the Zionists in the United States to keep supporting Saudi Arabia, or even to take a very active military role in this. The other side of the story, however, is that there is a growing, let's say, war fatigue in terms of Yemen in particular. Not in general, because the United States will unfortunately, I believe, never be sick of war completely. But lately, recently, we've seen 30 senators, I believe, that already now in the Senate itself have called for a complete and total, basically, military boycott of Saudi Arabia as long as this war continues. And this is not necessarily because the people are pacifists, but because they see that this is a conflict that they most likely cannot win. It has been dragging on for nearly 7 years now, and the United States has bigger fish to fry nowadays. The United States is still busy with a pivot to Asia, the pivot to China, trying to contain the rise of China. And so that's why they also withdrew from Afghanistan recently. So I believe that fortunately, all these things kept in consideration, that the United States will eventually have no other recourse but to dial back on the support that they give to Saudi Arabia, which will hopefully then also mean the total end of the Saudi invasion and the failure of the attack against Yemen.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Brett Jonkers, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council, for joining us to talk about the recent developments in Yemen, which most definitely will show even further development before the end of this year. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will talk about how the UK will ban Hamas. Now, years after Britain banned the military wing of Hamas, the Qassam Brigades, British Home Secretary Priti Patel announced her government's intention to include the movement itself among terrorist organizations. This week, the British Parliament will vote on amendments to the anti-terrorism laws to include Hamas. The British Home Secretary, who is used to spending her vacations in Zionist Israel, said that if this classification is adopted, whoever belongs to or promotes Hamas will be punished with imprisonment for a term that can reach up to 14 years under the provisions of the British Anti-Terrorism Act. I'm not even slightly surprised here. UK to ban Hamas resistance in this following report.
Days after the 104th anniversary of the infamous Balfour Declaration, the British Home Secretary Priti Patel announced her country's intention to classify Hamas in all its political and military forms as a terrorist organization, which the Zionist occupation celebrated, while Hamas described it as a British continuation of the old animosity. This week, the British Parliament will vote on amendments to the anti-terrorism laws to include Hamas. Supporting the movement with words, raising its flags, and meeting its activists will be considered, quote, illegal activities, end quote. In this context, Patel said that it is not possible to differentiate between the political and military wings of Hamas, claiming that the decision is based on widespread information that indicates that the movement has carried out, quote, terrorist activities, end quote. Patel even accused Hamas of anti-Semitism, considering the latest measure against it important for the safety of the Jewish community in Britain. I still fail to understand how an actual Semite can be branded as an anti-Semite, but let's move on. It took literally no time between Britain announcing this decision and the Zionist occupation celebrating it. Zionist Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked the United Kingdom, saying that there was no difference between the political and military wings of Hamas, adding the difference lies only in uniforms. Hamas is a radical Islamic organization that targets, quote, innocent Israelis and seeks to destroy Israel, end quote. Mind you, that came from the leader of a group of genocidal maniacs who were brought in by the Brits, wiped the native Palestinians off the face of their homeland, stole their homes and property, and pursued to kill and incarcerate anyone who dares to say no. While Bennett attributed the decision to his friendship with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid considered London's move as one of the fruits of his ministry's efforts. Meanwhile, Israel's Channel 12 reported that the Shin Bet provided a lot of materials and information that helped their foreign ministry deal with the British. The channel added that the Shin Bet also assisted in briefings with the decision makers in Britain to validate this new law. So yes, we completely believe that this was a British decision, not an Israeli-induced one, through the many political channels controlled by Tel Aviv, like none other than the Home Secretary herself. Since if it slipped your mind, we're here to remind you that Priti Patel was forced to step down as International Development Secretary back in 2017 because she failed to candid with her Prime Minister about 14 unofficial meetings with Israeli ministers, business people, and senior lobbyists while on, quote, family vacation, end quote, in Zionist Israel. Priti Patel's scandal, along with her current efforts solely in favor of Israel, speaks volume about the dark operations of the UK's powerful Israeli lobby. While the UK is regarded as one of Israel's most fervent supporters in Europe, the work of the likes of Patel should be a cause for public indignation. I fail to fathom how any nation would gleefully allow other foreign entities to enjoy such unabashed, high-level political support, while said foreign entity is nothing more than a force of occupation living on genocide since 1948.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ehsan Ataya, leader of the Islamic Jihad in Lebanon and the Palestine coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ataya, for being with us. Now, according to the UK Minister of Interior, this classification is actually adopted. Whoever belongs to or promotes Hamas will be punished with imprisonment for a term that can reach up to 14 years under the provisions of the so-called British Anti-Terrorism Act. What are the implications of such a decision if it passes in Parliament?
It's an attempt by Britain, the founding and leading country which established the Zionist project in our region in 1948. It's an attempt to save their project after it sank into a great quagmire following the Battle of Sayf al-Quds. It's also an attempt to pressure the Hamas government to pass the so-called Economic Peace Project, or a long truce, with the occupation entity. They seek to empty Gaza from its resistance and military content, and this resistance is an attempt to neutralize Gaza, the strip that threatens the Zionist entity in its presence on the path of liberating Palestine. Such a decision is not really a surprise coming from colonial power like Britain. However, this ban will be a test for the international community and for the laws and regulations of the United Nations. If it passes through UK Parliament this week, then it means Britain is breaking international law. Article 51 of the UN Charter gives the right to individuals and groups to resist any occupation and to use all means available to defend themselves, their property, and their nation. However, if this ban is approved, then it will not affect the work and power of the resistance. As long as there is an occupation in Palestine, there will always be a resistance to fight it. Palestinians have every right to fight back, especially in Gaza, the biggest open-air prison in the world.
Well, Ms. Ataya, no sooner had Britain announced this approach, if you will, until the occupying power celebrated it. And the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, thanked the United Kingdom, saying that there was no difference between the political and the military wing of Hamas. Why does it seem that they are looking for some sort of a green light for Israel to commit more massacres in Gaza? What do you think, as part of the Islamic Jihad, will this affect you as well as a resistance movement?
This classification does not diminish the importance of the resistance facing the Zionist project and the American project that greatly supports Zionism in the whole region. Therefore, by taking such a decision, we cannot say that Britain is giving a green light to the Zionist entity to commit more massacres, because the Zionist entity is committing massacres on a daily basis in Palestine. Israel commits violations on a daily basis and attacks the Palestinian people. It attacks residents of Al-Quds and their neighborhoods. It also attacks the Palestinians of the 1948 territories. It also violates the rights of prisoners and defenseless detainees from any possibility of facing this aggression except through their empty stomachs, through brave hunger strikes. Therefore, this British support, which gives an additional cover for the Zionist entity to perpetrate all these types of massacres, it also giving it a green light to continue this aggressive behavior against the Palestinian people in order to save their entity from the reality and the abyss in which it fell, especially after its military system was struck hard in the Battle of Sayf al-Quds. This battle deprived the Iron Dome of its effectiveness, as well as striking Israel's security prestige after the Freedom Tunnel operation, as well as yesterday's Al-Quds operation, which constituted an additional blow to the security system of the Zionist entity. This proves that the Palestinian people adhere to their resistance until the liberation of all of Palestine from the hands of the occupation and the liberation of the Palestinian people and the entire region from these Zionist aggressions, starting from occupied Palestine to include the entire surrounding region that is harmed by the existence of this entity. Unfortunately, there are some official Arab regimes who chose to collude with this dangerous Zionist American project in order to exert more pressure on the Palestinian people and their entire resistance axis.
Well,
Mr. Ataya, Hamas did respond to this announcement. We all heard them saying that this decision, if implemented, is actually considered a great political, moral, ethical, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first sin, which is actually establishing the Zionist entity by signing the illegal Balfour Declaration. But if Israel were really in control of the situation in occupied Palestine, it wouldn't continually seek whitewashing from Western powers. What does that tell you about the Zionist situation inside occupied Palestine?
Frankly, Britain does not care about any moral considerations with its behavior in support of the Zionist project in our region, nor does it pay attention to all the objections directed to it since the Balfour Declaration until this day. Britain is still pursuing this approach in support of the Zionist entity in order to complete its hegemony over the whole region and not only over Palestine. From here, we can say that Britain's view and that of the West in general for this entity is a view that considers Israel the only guarantee for their domination over the Arab and Islamic world. Therefore, they give priority to supporting this entity, mainly because this entity was shaken under the numerous strikes of the resistance, starting with its exit from South Lebanon under the strikes of the Lebanese resistance, as well as its exit from Gaza under the strikes of the resistance, and the many confrontations that the occupation faced in Gaza when hit with the resistance missiles, as well as the heroic operations that are being carried out inside occupied Palestine, whether in Al-Quds or in 1948 territories or in the West Bank. Therefore, this Zionist entity, whose status has been destabilized and faces a real danger to its existence in this period, we see Britain today at the forefront of direct support for this entity, stepping on all human values, diplomatic principles, and the decisions of the so-called international community and the United Nations that allow and legitimize resistance against any occupation. This British decision is in support of the Zionist entity, who is facing a crisis internally in order to tighten the grip on the resistance, which is dealing severe blows to it.
Well, we did all see together what happened 2 days ago with the amazing, heroic resistance operation that happened in Al-Quds and that will stop any sort of occupation inside occupied Palestine. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ihsan Ataya, leader of Islamic Jihad in Lebanon and Palestinian coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for your time and contribution. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 has passed 800,000, a once unimaginable figure seen as doubly tragic given that more than 200,000 of those lives were lost after vaccines became available last spring. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, A Terrible Tragedy, U.S. Passes 800,000 COVID Deaths, Highest in the World. Stay with us for more. The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 has passed 800,000, a once unimaginable figure seen as doubly tragic given that more than 200,000 of those lives were lost after vaccines became available last spring. The figure represents the highest reported death toll of any country in the world and is likely even higher. The United States accounts for approximately 4% of the world's population, but about 15% of the 5.3 million known deaths from the coronavirus since the outbreak began in China 2 years ago. The grim milestone comes as the world braces for rising cases of the new Omicron variant, with the World Health Organization, WHO, warning it was spreading at an unprecedented rate. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told reporters on Tuesday, 14th of December, the variant had been detected in 77 countries and was probably present in most countries worldwide. The Omicron variant, first detected by South Africa and reported to the World Health Organization on 24th of November, has a large number of mutations, which has concerned scientists. The new variant, Omicron, is posing a fresh threat as it gains a foothold in the United States, though experts are not yet sure how dangerous it is. The number of COVID deaths in the United States, compiled and released by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday, 14th of December, is about equal to the population of the cities of Atlanta and St. Louis combined, or Minneapolis and Cleveland put together. It is roughly equivalent to how many Americans die each year from heart disease or stroke. A closely watched forecasting model from the University of Washington projects a total of over 880,000 reported deaths in the United States by 1st of March. The deadly milestone comes as cases and hospitalizations are on the rise again in the United States, a spike driven by the highly contagious Delta variant, which arrived in the first half of 2021 and now accounts for nearly all infections. Health experts lament that many of the deaths in the United States were especially heartbreaking because the widely available and effective vaccines made them preventable. About 200 million Americans are fully vaccinated, or just over 60% of the population, but that is well short of what scientists say is needed to keep the virus in check. Almost all the people dying are now dying preventable deaths, said Dr. Chris Behrer, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Chris Behrer added, and that's because they're not immunized. When the vaccine was first rolled out, the country's death toll stood at about 300,000. It hit 600,000 in mid-June and 700,000 on 1st of October. Dr. Chris Behrer recalled that in March or April of 2020, one of the worst-case scenarios projected upwards of 240,000 American deaths. And I saw that number and I thought that is incredible, 240,000 American deaths, he said. And we're now past three times that number, he added, and I think it's fair to say that we're still not out of the woods. Meanwhile, a new study in South Africa has found that the new Omicron coronavirus variant appears to cause less severe disease than previous versions of the virus, but also decreases the protection offered by two doses of the Pfizer vaccine. The preliminary study from Discovery Health, South Africa's largest health insurer, looked at over 200,000 coronavirus cases. Nearly 80,000 of those cases were attributable to the Omicron variant. The researchers found that of the Omicron cases, hospitalizations were nearly 30% lower than the rates seen at the start of the pandemic. Conclusions consistent with early observations about the strain. But researchers also found that the protection against symptomatic infection offered by two shots of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine against Omicron drops to 33%, and the shots offer 70% protection against severe disease from Omicron. It's a significant drop from roughly 90% efficacy against severe disease from the Delta variant. Pfizer has said that a third dose of its vaccine appears to produce levels of Omicron-fighting antibodies similar to what just two doses of the vaccine produced against the original coronavirus strain. Pfizer also confirmed on Tuesday, 14th of December, that its COVID-19 antiviral pill is highly effective at preventing hospitalizations and deaths, and the company indicated that laboratory data shows the pill has the potential to maintain robust antiviral activity against Omicron. The study in South Africa also found an increased risk of reinfection during the country's fourth coronavirus wave and noted a 20% higher risk of hospitalization among children, despite a very low absolute incidence. The variant has been found in more than 30 states in the United States. According to data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, Omicron makes up nearly 3% of new coronavirus cases in the United States. The head of the CDC last week said the most US cases of the variant have been mild. Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Wouldn't want to hold on to his parents that much longer. An advanced technology and better health standards have granted that wish. But what if a population just goes on aging with no one to replace it? Well, with family planning and population control, Iran has gotten more than it asked for.
Hence the motto, more children, stronger family. Sharp turn, as just 20 years ago, the motto was fewer children, better life. The thing is, every national policy is to help a nation prosper and have the nation protect it. And what Iran needs now is to grow a younger population. I'd say in moderation, given the economic and environmental situation of the country. So how do you get that delicate balance between numbers and conditions? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Iran was one of the first countries to establish a family planning program. That was in 1967. But religion is not big on contraception, and the Islamic Revolution of 1979 would also require a bigger Islamic population. So in advocating population growth, the new governing body dismantled the family planning program. A population of just over 37 million increased to about 50 million by 1986, with a growth rate of over 3% per year. But a war can change much.
Mr. Abdullah, he is a sociologist and Hojjatul Islam. That's a high-ranking cleric who made a trek down to Press TV studios for an interview.
There are four factors involved in population and demographic changes. One is marriage, the other divorce, immigration and war, all of which we've already witnessed. We've experienced war during which many went to the front lines and lost their lives for the country. The other factor which is also related to war was that many of our intellectuals and scientists had to immigrate when they saw the atmosphere in the country unsuitable for living.
As the eight-year Iraq-Iran war came to an end in 1988, the government began to view rapid population growth as a major obstacle to the economic and social development of the country. And so, family planning was revived to promote small family size. In a pragmatic move which surprised many in 1993, Parliament passed a bill that removed most economic incentives for large families, while still paying attention to reducing infant mortality. The target was bringing total fertility down to 4 births per woman by 2011. But by 2000, the rate was already down to half that goal, and now Iran is faced with under 1.7 births per woman. This is while just sustaining a given population requires 2.1 births per woman. While the country's fertility rate today has reached about 1.6 children per woman, it was 6.5 children per woman in 1986. Just under 1,600,000 births were registered between March 2015 and 2016, but only about 1 million were registered between March 2020 and 2021. That's within 5 years. Ms. Ghaz Ali, PhD, is chair of the Supreme Cultural Revolution Council.
Natural population decline is very different from a voluntary one. The voluntary population decline is due to population control, abortion, and the secular Western culture that gives people the impression that everything revolves around them, their desires, and their pleasures. Under that culture, a woman would seek education, then employment, and then a permanent job. In the meantime, she won't have the time for marriage and bearing children, so she'll put that off. A collection of all these will cost a girl her ability to bear children. In such a cultural environment where pleasure, power, and wealth are the only priorities, the birth rate will be on the decline.
The first concern is a potential labor crisis. Teenagers who were at high school between 1987 to 1991 are now in the labor market. This has opened a window of opportunity for production in the country. If we don't take advantage of the opportunity, that would lead to a population of senior citizens. If today, for example, we need to care for one senior citizen, we'll need to care for 15 in 2051. Imagine the workforce that is being added to that number. We're losing 15% of our workforce every year. We haven't seen any policy implemented to address the challenges related to the labor market, economy, workforce, and how we can keep them from retiring.
And a word of concern by Mohammed Ismail Akbari, senior advisor to the Minister of Health. The world has grown about 5 years older over the past 70 years. But the population of Iran has grown 10 years older in the past 60 years. As recently as 2020, Iran was recorded as having a population growth of 1.3%. The rate in neighboring Iraq was 2.3%, and in Saudi Arabia, it was 1.8%. That's according to World Bank data.
Our biggest challenge is political and security issues. Manpower is of prime importance in wars. If we have a mighty army, if we have a strong military power, we'll be safe from the threat of an invasion. But if our neighbors find out that our security forces and our ability to protect our borders have diminished due to the population decline, they'll certainly attack and divide our country.
Now, in 2021, senior citizens constitute about a tenth of Iran's 85 million strong population. While the country's population growth is less than 1.4%, the growth of the elderly is 3%. The elderly's population has increased from about 5 to 10% over the course of 5 decades, and it is predicted that this rate will triple in the next 50 years. Before anyone, this will be to the disadvantage of the elderly, because they will need the care of a dwindling productive population. a productive population or portion of society being between 15 and 65 years of age.
The government has taken all of these into account to turn them into past laws. It is pushing for economic solutions which will see, for example, food and medicine packages delivered to the homes of the people who are in their three lower income deciles. It will also provide them with the means necessary to undergo tests, be covered by maternal insurance. There are currently 3 million married couples, that is 6 million married people who are waiting for their first child, which is ruining their lives. Measures must be taken to prevent and treat infertility for them, for which insurance is introduced. They might be students and need loans for buying homes and getting married and starting a family.
Any shortages with people numbers, there's still time to make up for because Iran's a young country. Still young, but aging, with frightfully low birth rates. The marriage rate alone has dropped by 40% in a decade, and alarms have been raised that in the next 20 years, Iran will be among the oldest countries in the world, and in the next 30 years, the oldest.
What measure is the greater government taking to address its population concern? It has approved a law that was on November the 17th to implement a population growth and family support plan for 7 years to reverse the declining trend of childbearing. The law is called the Family Support and Population Rejuvenation Law, and it outlaws sterilization and free distribution of contraceptives in the public health care system. That's unless a pregnancy threatens a woman's health, of course. Ms. Mohammad Beghi, PhD, is an MP. She came to share her views in the studio.
A problem we used to have was that over 3.5 million infertile couples in Iran weren't covered by insurance. We've attempted to cover 90% of the infertility treatment costs for IUI, IVF, and other cycles under insurance for the first time in Iran. About 30 of the 74 articles are related to the mother and child's health. 20 articles are related to the health ministry. Several articles are related to the Ministry of Science, Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, and media like the IRIB. I believe about 7 articles are related to home loans from the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development and creating dormitories for married student couples, all of which are under the umbrella of providing housing for young couples. There are some financial facilities provided, including loans for the first to fifth children, which increases by a coefficient according to the number of children.
The plan stipulates, say, health insurance for infertile couples, providing services and facilities to working women, educational opportunities for student mothers, and ongoing medical services to pregnant women. Thing is, looking at global examples, it takes more than benefit packages that are out of proportion with general taxes and daily expenses to encourage sustainable coupling and childbearing. And money is not everything. Social attitude and belief and values also play a major role in the process.
Social issues are multi-layered and result from a complex set of factors. It's not scientific to emphasize a particular factor too much. Economic, cultural, social, political, and international issues certainly have their effects. The middle class in our society is more developed and doesn't suffer from the afflictions and problems of the poorer bracket. They lead healthier lives, and that's why they get married and bear children. Some 20 million households in the country are from the very group. Therefore, if the economy was an important factor, the rich must have been responsible for the highest birth rates.
We popped out to see how the man and woman on the street feels about having kids and government perks. Also, why they think marriage rates and the population are dwindling.
The economic situation is such that we can't have any more than 2 children, but the child brings joy to life.
The incomes are really low. I'm witnessing it myself. I have 2 children. They both go to work.
If they want to increase the population, they have to plan for what that takes too. That includes education, employment, and housing. They demanded in 1979 that the population be increased. It did, but then everyone got into trouble. The situation in society is now such that it is economically difficult for anyone to get married at all. One might want to get married and have children. After all, everyone likes to get themselves together.
I don't know, maybe after the prices come down. Everyone's afraid right now. They buy things today because they could go out of stock tomorrow.
In 20 years, we'll be an old country. We'd have neither any youth nor a proper workforce. The support isn't important at this point. What they'll do in 10, 15 years will be important.
It's now apt to say the fewer the children, the better, because people can't make ends meet. Back in our day, there were a lot of kids and we enjoyed our time at home, but kids these days want it all.
There may be a lot of people thinking about getting married, but they are afraid of its problems. It doesn't matter if they are living in rich neighborhoods or not. They see the problems the married couples are dealing with. Maybe they are afraid of having the same problems.
For a short break. We'll be back in no time. To take a look at other countries, according to the UN, two-thirds of European countries have introduced measures to increase fertility rates, from baby bonuses and tax incentives to paid parental leave. It hasn't worked equally everywhere, and it generally tends to boost childbirth temporarily. But in the long term, it is stability, meaning having a home and country, and security, that is financial certainty as well as social preferences, that keep a population stable or growing. Italy launched an incentive package in 2015. That was an €800 payment per couple per birth. But Italy still has one of the lowest fertility rates in the EU, with 1.3 children per woman. More on other countries' measures and success rates after a quick media review, which will also be looking at other lands and their populations. For that, I give you Mohammed.
Welcome. I am Mohammed Gord, and in this episode's news section, we will be taking a look at the different problems of an aging population in various countries. Generally speaking, a rapidly aging population means fewer working-age people in an economy. And this in turn leads to a supply shortage of qualified workers, making it difficult for businesses to fill in-demand roles. On this issue, in an article titled "Middle-Aged Iran, Zero Population Growth in 20 Years," Tehran Times says, "Population growth requires a capability to address the needs of a young nation." And according to the report, this can be achieved by various means, including social and economic development, development of recreational and educational facilities, increasing the share of young people in managerial positions and among decision makers, and providing the conditions for growth and prosperity of the youth. 2 years ago, members of Majlis, the Iranian parliament, passed a law banning the employment of retirees. But to what extent has this been implemented? Statistics show that a quarter of the country's young population is quite absent in decision-making positions. However, if this young population is not exposed to practical empowerment, they will certainly face challenges in the future and will not be able to use existing opportunities for growth and lose the opportunity in management and decision-making. Meanwhile, BBC has also touched on the issue and released a report titled "Seven Countries with Big and Small Population Problems." BBC cites a new study published in the Lancet Medical Journal which suggests falling fertility rates mean nearly every country could have shrinking populations by the end of the century, and warns of a, quote, jaw-dropping impact on societies. The article takes a look at seven countries facing some of the most dramatic population changes and the measures they're taking to combat this issue. Japan already has the world's oldest population and the highest rate of people over the age of 100. This has put a strain on the country's workforce, and the problem is only expected to worsen. Official forecasts say elderly people will account for more than 35% of the population by 2040. According to a Lancet study, the Italian population is expected to more than halve, from 61 million in 2017 to 28 million by the end of the century. The study predicts that China's population will peak at 1.4 billion in 4 years' time before nearly halving to 732 million by the year 2100. Official data showed the country's birth rate had fallen to its lowest level in 70 years in 2019. Iran is also expected to see its population significantly decline by the end of the century. The country experienced a population boom after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but went on to implement an effective population control policy. Brazil has experienced a dramatic decline in fertility rates over the past 40 years, from about 6.3 births per woman in 1960 to 1.7 in the most recent estimates. The Lancet study projects that Brazil's population will decline from about 211 million in 2017 to less than 164 million in 2100. India is expected to overtake China as the most populous country in the world by 2100, according to the new study. This is despite the fact that the size of its population is expected to decline from today's numbers, dropping from 1.3 billion in 2017 to less than 1.1 billion by the end of the century. Nigeria and other countries in Africa are bucking the trend of population decline. According to the new Lancet study, the population of sub-Saharan Africa is expected to treble in size to more than 3 billion people by 2100. But rapid population expansion puts a strain on infrastructure and social structures, and Nigerian officials have spoken about trying to ease population growth.
Thanks for joining me in this week's news section, and now back to data.
France, with 1.92 births per woman, one of the highest fertility rates in the EU going by World Bank figures of 2017, is a demographic exception in Europe. That should be due to its balanced range of social policies. They offer subsidized childcare for younger children and a generous benefit system, especially for larger families, according to the European Commission.
I cite the United Nations and the Western viewpoint that values materialism and the economy. They believe that population means wealth and power. They believe four factors contribute to economic growth. One is having lands, facilities, and resources to make good money off. The second is the workforce, who work on the land and mines and the resources. The third is the technology and know-how to increase the efficiency of production. They believe it's workforce that can work on the materials and resources and make production work. If that's a strong population, wealth can be made. Else, we'll have to face poverty and prepare for extinction with the old population despite having rich resources.
Here's how Sweden has lived it. According to the European Commission, female and maternal employment rates in the country are among the highest in the EU, and child poverty is among the lowest. This is while parents are given a monthly allowance of around 1,500 kronas, that's $167, and the sum increases when the child reaches 11 and then 15.
Now, Iran has also made an effort of its own, passing a law, although the pragmatism of that law is yet to be seen once it's put into full practice. Focusing on shaping young minds in fertile bodies, the law stipulates that all higher education centers in the country must promote awareness towards the positive aspects of childbearing.
Another issue taken into consideration in the juvenilization of the population as support for young couples. Imagine recently married couples who are students. Some 10% of budgets for the Ministry of Science, Ministry of Health, and the construction budget of the seminary are earmarked for building dormitories for married couples and their housing so they can experience parenthood at an early age. This is because, according to statistics, unfortunately, the average age at which women marry in Iran is 24. The figure is 29 for Iranian men. The families also bear children 4 to 5 years after marriage. With a quick calculation, you'll realize that an Iranian woman experiences motherhood at 29. This is while the best age for motherhood is between 20 to 24.
Iranian ministries of interior, sports and culture and other relevant institutions are obliged to allocate 30% of their budgets to NGOs that work to reduce the age of marriage and encourage childbearing. Employees with 3 to 5 children will be promoted and maternity leave will be extended to 9 months, while paying full salary and relevant extras. The government is obliged to establish a life insurance and investment fund for unemployed housewives with three or more children living in rural and nomadic areas. This would happen by paying 70% of the life and investment insurance premiums. The Ministry of Health is to provide quality natural childbirth in state-run hospitals, in addition to providing free infertility treatment to the couples. Municipal public transportation services and cultural, sports and recreational tariffs are to be halved, and tuition for children in private schools and educational centers would include a 20% discount. Also, all production, distribution,